That's the first thing. Secondly, your answers to the study questions on the coronation of Charlemagne will be due a week from today. A week from today. That is next Tuesday. And finally, the midterm in this course will be approximately, this is less of the more, approximately 3 weeks from yesterday. So we will not necessarily have it on Monday, but it will be around that time. We can establish that more definitely as we approach closer to the day. Today, then, we would like to look at early medieval mission developments. There is one book that I would like to recommend particularly beyond those, or especially from those that are listed in your bibliography, and that is the work by Addison, Medieval Mission. You have perhaps already used this book for one or another projects that you have done. I think you'll find it the most helpful of all of the books on this period. Kenneth Scott Lotterett, whom some of you will perhaps know on this subject, took a great deal of his material also from Addison. And Addison does a very interesting job, quite reliable. We'd like to begin this discussion of medieval missions by looking at the state of Christianity on the English Isles, first of all, because they play such an important part in the Christianization, in that missionary enterprise which takes place after the conversion of the Germanic tribes, the Burgundians and the Franks and the Visigoths and so forth. They play such an important part in the conversion of the rest of Europe, including Germany and Scandinavia. So we want to begin by looking at England. The great source for English ecclesiastical history is the Venerable Bede, who died in 735. We have already discussed Bede as an exegete, suggesting that his studies of the Holy Scripture owe a great deal to Jerome. But more important than this, perhaps, for what we are considering in this part of the first unit, missions, is his ecclesiastical history, a continuation of that history that Eusebius began. However, Bede speaks of ecclesiastical history primarily on the English Isles. He begins more or less with the Roman mission to England in the early first decade of the 7th century. Kent, the King of Kent, is converted in 601 and takes it down pretty much to his own time. This ecclesiastical history is a great work. It was widely read, translated from the original into Latin so that it could be used in those areas of Europe where Anglo-Saxon or English was not spoken. Bede and the ecclesiastical history is used by all of the historians of church history since Bede. And perhaps the fact that it has been used by all historians since is not as important as the fact that this is the first real insight that we get into what has been going on in this area of the world. Prior to the 8th century, the documents concerning the story of the church in England are fragmentary, to say the very least. Indeed, most of them are rather mythological, tales about great men, rather than concise and precise ecclesiastical history. That's why we begin here, because most of the material that we will be talking about today in connection with England does rely more or less on deed history, just as the study of the ancient church relies more or less on Eusebius' history. Bede is known also for the fact that he popularized the chronological system of B.C. and A.D. And this is also extremely important, of course, for the rest of church history, as well as for history in general. You will recall that this was the work primarily of Dionysius Exiguus, dividing history into that period before Christ and that period after Christ, a fifth century monk, but it is not popularized until you have it used by Bede, and that is its popularization. Fourthly, Bede knew Greek, and finally, there are a good many studies of his related to the trivium and the quadrivium, so that he is important not only for his study of the church, his history of the church, but he is also important for these other areas in the development of the early medieval intellectual tradition. If you read some of the historians, for example, Dawson's Making of Europe, or a book that I read just recently by Nora Chadwick on the saints of ancient England and the Celtic saints, you find a great many statements about the importance of Bede, no matter what you read. He was a very learned man, and it gives us a great deal of what we know about Christianity in England and the spread of Christianity there on this period. Now, secondly, aside from Bede, or prior to Bede's material, concerning the nature of Christianity in England, in other words, prior to the material that he gives us, most of the questions remain questions, so that we entitle Bede Questions, or the Question of Christian Origins. Bede himself tells us that Christianity came to England in the first place in the first century, when one of the kings of England wrote the bishop of the Roman Church, the church in Rome, and asked for missionaries. Sometimes this is related to the reign of Tiberius. It is more than likely a result of the more ancient tradition that the 12 disciples of our Lord divided the world into 12 parts, of which the English Isles were one. And it is clearly related in Bede's mind to Psalm 19, which was interpreted allegorically to refer to the spreading of the gospel to the four corners of the earth in the ancient church. There are references to Christians in England in the early fathers as early as the 200s, Tertullian and Origen. Tertullian says there are places in Britain inaccessible to the Romans, subject to Christ. Exactly what he is talking about there around the year 200 is quite difficult. one of the more intriguing interpretations of this passage would be that Tertullian is referring to this place as the residence of the dead, since the sun set on the English Isles, as far as Europe was concerned, and since these islands are referred to in a number of classical authors as the residence of the dead, you probably know that they argued about that. The Stoics rejected the idea of Hades in the center of the earth because they claimed the earth was solid. And the question arose then, well, if the dead people aren't in the middle of the earth, where are they? And many of the Stoics suggested that since the soul is an ethereal kind of substance, it would reside most naturally in another ethereal kind of substance, and that would be the atmosphere. And so they assumed that dead souls join the stars and things of that sort, about which we, of course, know from our earlier studies. But another interpretation, another suggestion was that all souls resided in this place of the dead, as it were, in the far west, where the sun also rested. And that would then be the English Isles. In any case, the only reason I bring this up is to suggest that the interpretation of what the fathers mean when they say this is very difficult, since they do not expand on it, and none of them actually suggest any more than that there are Christians beyond the power of Roman authority. The first Christians that we know of coming from the English Isles are from the year 314. They were at the Council of Arles. You recall, one of those Western councils just prior to the Council of Nicaea, dealing with the problems of lapsing during the persecution of Diocletian. These English representatives did sign the canons of that council. So that there were Christians in England by the 4th century. Then the next question is, how did they get there? Some have suggested St. Paul. Others have suggested Joseph of Arimathea, who supposedly brought Christianity to Glastonbury, which is one of those shrines of the English church even today yet, down here in southern England, Glastonbury. If you read anything about medieval England, you will know the importance of Glastonbury. This suggestion was first made that Glastonbury was the original seat for Christianity in England. That was first made by William of Malmesbury in the 12th century. That's rather unimportant. The point, however, is that when you go back beyond these, except for this one incident in the 4th century, you are moving back more and more into material that is less and less reliable. See then, we do know, however, that around the year 400, the continental church took an interest in the welfare of the Christians on the island. This revolves primarily around Pelagianism. You remember that Pelagius was an Englishman. He came from the island. When he is condemned on the continent, especially in the West, it seems that the continental churches became a little bit concerned about the Catholicity of the rest of Christianity on these islands. And so they sent over individuals to check on this. One of the most important names in connection with this is Germanus, who went over in 429. Germanus was the bishop of Auxerre in Gaul. What relationship this Auxerre, by the way, is in Burgundy. It's straight west of Brittany here, right about in here, if I'm not confusing the matter with my fingers, this was an emissary from Gaul. That is clear. He was the bishop of Auxerre, but the further question is what relationship this particular emissary to the English Isles had to the Bishop of Rome, specifically Celestine at this time, and whether this has anything to do with the Roman claim to jurisdiction over every section of the church. I think we have to allow that this is very questionable. That is, it's very questionable what kind of role the Roman bishop played in any efforts to bring the Christians on the English Isles away from their supposed sympathy to Pelagianism. This coincides with the withdrawal of Roman troops from the English Isles in 407. This was the time when the Romans in the west, under Emperor Honorius, the successor of Theodosius, were fighting the Visigoths, you recall. It coincides with their withdrawal to fight the Visigoths on the continent and the attack at the same time on the English Isles of new tribal groups, the Picts from what we know today as Scotland on the southern areas of England, and the Celts or the Celts, and then the Angles, who probably came from southern Denmark, and the Saxons, who came from northwest Europe, and then the Jutes, who also came from Denmark and possibly Sweden. The only description we have of the confusion that took place with the withdrawal of the Roman troops and the invasion of these various tribes of the southern part of the island comes from Gildas, G-I-L-D-A-S, his complaint. Now, this is the kind of history you have prior to Bede. It's a complaint. When he talks about the Romans, he describes them as flying on horseback like eagles to slaughter the fierce aggressors till they fell thick and fast as leaves fall in due season. It's really not history. More poetry than anything else. And it doesn't tell us too much about the facts of the matter, except that there was a great deal of confusion, evidently, in England. Gildas blames the English people for not being happy with Roman authority for the horrible things that are befalling them with Rome's withdrawal. So in any case, this coincides with the problem of Pelagianism in England, and those are the only really, that's the only date, the only references that we have, aside from this 300 date, or the next reference that we had after the 300 date, to Christianity in England. Then you have the various stories associated with the work, the role of St. Patrick in England, whose work also centers around the year 400, 430. He worked primarily in Northern Ireland, that which we know today as Northern Ireland. And once again, the question arises whether his work on the islands had anything particularly to do with, first of all, the delegation of the Frankish Church to the Isles in connection with Pelagius, and whether it had anything to do with the Roman bishop. There are many stories about this. And depending on which life of St. Patrick you read, you get a different version. There is an interesting article, at least, if not altogether up to date, in the Concordia Theological Monthly of 1948, pages 28 to 33. It was written by the same individual who wrote this history of preaching a while back, Pastor Weber, and reflects those concerns. But I think you'll find it rather interesting on St. Patrick. I always like to note when there is a historical article in the CCF. Now, all of this that we have discussed so far is prior to any specifically or any, any specifically continental interest in evangelizing the English Isles. What we are talking about, and when we're talking about Patrick, and when we're talking about this the home of Pelagius, and when we're talking about delegates to Arles, is a Celtic Christianity, as distinct from a Catholic Christianity. A Celtic Christianity that was monastic in character. Where their monastic ideas came from is just as questionable as where their Christianity came from. Some suggest that the traditions seem to rely more heavily on Eastern monasticism in a non-Western sense. Others suggest Gaul as a center. Either are possible because there was extensive trade between both the Eastern Mediterranean and Gaul with the islands that we know today as England. But in any case, we do have lives of saints from this early period, which indicate that there were centers of Christianity in England that were other than Catholic. That is, they have different traditions from the tradition of Catholic Christianity on the continent. The three centers that I have listed there, these are not the only ones, are those of St. Illtyd, first of all, in Wales. Wales, as you know, is this area here on the English Islands, one of the more important centers of Welsh Christianity is Bangor, up here in the northern part of Wales. Then another area that is very important is this island of Iona, up here, from which a good number of wanderers set out to more or less convert areas of England and of Europe, continental Europe. Europe sets out to convert England at the same time that Englishmen set out to convert Europe. Columba is the great saint from the island of Iona, and because of whom we know anything about this place, around the year 563. And then on the other side of the island, notice all this is in the northern part, not down here. Wales over here is always separate from Roman Gaul, which is this part of the island. Mercia, Northumbria, and Kent down here. Beyond that, you get into the area of the Picts, the Scots, and the Celts, and the Welsh over here, which are really never Romanized. Any case, the other area is this one up here, the island of Lindisfarne, which is famous because of Aidan, who becomes prominent in the 7th century. We'll be talking about these individuals presently. There are the names and the dates. Of this Christianity in England. There's a very good book on this, by the way, by Willis Bund. It's in your bibliography, Willis-Bund, The Celtic Saints or the Celtic Church in Wales. I think you'll find that very interesting. It's from the last century, but it is still a very fine and interesting book to read. These monasteries were the centers of administration in England. Now here again, there's a great deal of debate. That's why I put religious in parentheses, because some suggest that the authority, political authority in England in these early years resided in these monastic groups. But it's more than likely true that what they administered was the church in England, that the church, the religious affairs, were administered from these retreat houses, these monastic centers. In any case, the relationship between these monasteries and political administration, if it is distinct, is ambiguous. These individuals, these leaders like Iltut especially, and Columba and Iden, play a very important role, not only in purely religious affairs, but also in civil and political affairs. And a suggestion by some of the scholars is that, at least in the earlier years, these monasteries not only controlled the religious life of the island, but also much more than that. They were also schools. All of the clergy in England in these early years were trained at these retreat houses, these monastic houses. The great art, the gospel, the copying of the gospel, the Book of Kells, one of the tradition of illuminated manuscripts, all of this comes from houses like those that we have mentioned in on Iona and Lindisfarne and so forth. But for our purposes, the most important thing is that it is from these retreats, these monastic centers, that the great missionaries come. The Peregrini, that should not be P-E-T, but P-E-R-E, Peregrini. I think the best discussion that I know of on these individuals is in Reeves's edition, R-E-E-V-E-S, edition of Adamnan's, A-D-O-M-N-A-N, Adamnan's Life of Columba. This, I think, you'll find the best discussion that I know of the materials, the documents, and so forth in connection with these Peregrini. In other words, many of the individuals who lived in these retreat houses did not stay there, but rather imposed upon themselves an exile. They were wanderers. And this wandering was considered martyrdom. This is the way they sought martyrdom. So just as you have the acts of the martyrs in the early church, you now get the lives of the saints in the medieval church, who are, especially those English saints of whom we have lives, who are primarily wanderers, the lives of the wanderers. It was a kind of martyrdom, a way of being a martyr, in a different way from being killed. One of the documents that we have from this time that I owe to Chadwick says there are three kinds of martyrdom which are counted as bearing the cross. There is white martyrdom, green martyrdom, and red martyrdom. This is white martyrdom, when a man separates himself for the sake of God from everything that he loves, although as a result he suffers labor and hardship. Green martyrdom is when, by means of fasting and labor, he separates from his desires and suffers penance, or does penance and suffers in that way. In other words, white martyrdom is to separate yourself from your home. That's the kind of martyrdom we're talking about. Green martyrdom is to discipline the body for the sake of the life of the soul. And then red martyrdom is the endurance of the cross or destruction for Christ's sake, as happened to the apostles
in times of persecution. In other words, to die, to shed your blood for Christ. You have these kinds of martyrdom. Well, the one, as I indicated, is to wander over the face of the earth. The great comparison here Adam's life of Columba is to Abram. God counseled Abram to leave his own country and go in pilgrimage into the land which God had showed him, that is, the land of promise. Now, the good counsel which God enjoined here on the father of the faithful is incumbent, then, on all of the faithful. That is, to leave their country and their land, their wealth, their worldly delight for the sake of the Lord of the elements, and to go into a perfect pilgrimage in imitation, interestingly enough, of Abram. Jacob, in her work on these wandering saints, said that to become a peregrinus, a stranger, an exile, was for the love of Christ. To leave one's home, to strip oneself of family, to root out from the heart and mind all of one's own aims and desires, and for a self the utmost in self-denial, to forsake one's native land for some lonely and remote spot, there to abide with no thought of return, with no plan, not even a plan of mission, a penance, or pilgrimage. Just simply to go. Simply to wander into the desert. And it's interesting that in these saints' lives, Burgundy, Lindisfarne, referred to as the desert. This is where one goes when one goes into the desert. Since, obviously, there was no Chalcis, east of Antioch, nor Egyptian desert on the English island. Usually these peregrini would go out two by two because they had to have somebody to confess and to absolve them in turn. Very important because much of the development that takes place in the medieval traditions relating to penance comes from these Irish peregrini. In any case, they wandered widely, coming south into the lower part of England where the Angles and the Saxons lived, and also going across the Channel into Central Europe, into that area that is today between France and Germany, that we know of from the medieval period as Burgundy. Okay, I think that's enough for the period around 400 and thereafter. Now to turn to the next great period in English history, that period that Bede talks about, that is the period after 600. It was at the end of the 6th century, or right before 600, that in 597, that Pope Gregory I, sends a missionary, Augustine, to England to convert the island. Now, whether Gregory knew that there was any Christianity there or whether he didn't, this is another one of those debated points. In any case, he sent Augustine to an island where Christianity was already known to convert it. This was, as I said, in 597. I think we should be careful that we don't confuse this Augustine of Canterbury with the other Augustine that we have already studied, Augustine of Hippo, who dies in 430, as you recall. This is not the same Augustine. Now, when the Bishop of Rome sends a missionary to the English Isles to convert them, the obvious thing that happens is a conflict between the Catholic, continental kind of Christianity, and the Christianity of the British Islands, or what we know as Celtic Christianity. Now, to understand this, I think we should say, first of all, that there was no great difference in theology here. That wasn't the problem. The continental fear that the island was infested with Pelagianism was unfounded. At least it was as unfounded as was any fear that the continent itself was infested with Pelagians. The problem wasn't theology as much as it was tradition. The Celtic Christians celebrated Easter, for example, according to a different calendar from the calendar that was used on the continent. The calendar that was by and large followed in Western Europe was that which was established at Nicaea and then revised every 100 or 200 years in Europe. And it so happens that the calendar that the Celtic Christians used was one of the older calendars from the calendar that was now being used in Christian Europe. So you have sort of a medieval quartodeciman controversy again about the dating of Easter, revolving not around whether one celebrates it on a particular day of the month or a particular day of the week, but around which calendar one is observing when Easter is celebrated. Now, we would suggest that this would probably be very easy to settle if there were not so many other things involved. Another one of those traditional differences was the way the Irish monks cut their hair, differing from the way a Benedictine, for example, would cut his hair. When they baptized, they immersed only once instead of three times. Things of this sort. This is where the differences were. But actually, the conflict is much deeper than this. It's a conflict between, it's sort of like a patriotism. I'm English, you're a foreigner, this kind of thing. The Celtic Christianity, Irish Christianity, never does become as highly organized. It's much more severe, but it is not as highly organized as is continental monasticism, the Benedictine monks. When Augustine comes to England, sent by Gregory, he comes with the idea of establishing monasteries according to the Benedictine rule. Well, when he finds monasteries there already, the obvious solution is to make them Benedictine. Well, they are not interested in this. And these are the areas where the conflict really arise. There's one letter from the period which pretty well summarizes the problem. An English writer said, "Rome is wrong, Jerusalem was wrong, Alexandria erred, Antioch erred, the whole world is wrong, Scotland and Britain alone think right." This is pretty much the essence of the problem, and it presented any kind resulted in a great deal of strife in the 7th century. The other problem is that when Augustine came to England, he came to this area here, southeastern England, to the area of the Jutes, and the areas north here of the Angles and Saxons, who had, since their invasion in 400, never found any peace, especially with the Welsh over here, nor with the Picts in this area here, in that intermediate area between the south and the north, as we know it today. So that when the continental missionaries came to the Angles and the Saxons, they missionized within a group that was at political odds with the older residents of the islands itself. You all know a parallel account to all of this from the 11th century when the Normans invade the islands, which are that time considered to be the divinely given home of the Angles and the Saxons. The two names that are important here for the Roman mission to England are Augustine, and then the other is Theodore of Tarsus. Great deal of debate again about which one of these two is the more important. Certainly, one cannot minimize the contributions of a man like Augustine of Canterbury to the religious traditions of England, but actually it is Theodore of Tarsus, one of his successors at Canterbury, who brings, actually Theodore was at York, who brings order who brings some kind of order out of the chaos between the Celtic and the continental traditions on the island. It is during his episcopate that the Synod of Whitby was held, where this whole business was debated, where the Roman debater won the debate, but where the Celt went home saying, win or lose, we're not going to change. This obtained until the Synod of Hereford in 672. I think the place of these two synods is interesting in itself. Whitby over here, which is not important for notes or anything like that, very definitely in Northumbria, an Anglo-Saxon area, whereas the Synod of Hereford takes place over here, which is in one of those borderland areas between the Welsh and the Anglo-Saxon areas. It's almost like those fellows that are still bickering with the Chinese Reds over there in Korea, where the table where all of the debating takes place strides the line between North and South Korea. The North Koreans will not negotiate on South Korean soil, nor will South Koreans negotiate on North Korean soil. Well, that's the way it was here. So that Whitby wasn't really successful, but Hereford, being sort of in the middle, was able to resolve it. This takes place after Theodore of Tarsus's episcopate, but in reality, a great deal of the groundwork was laid by him. The canons from these councils can be found in Bettinson on pages 218 and following, if you are interested in looking them up for some further effort. Now we move to the next step in the history of medieval missions, and that is the efforts of English monks, English missionaries, to Christianize northern areas in northern Europe that have not yet been reached by the Christian gospel. Excuse me. The most important individual, first of all, here is Columbanus. Not to be confused with Columba. I always have some difficulty in talking about this next period now, because what I'm doing is primarily giving you a lot of names and dates and places. The only way you can really study this is to actually read the lives of these men and to see what kind of work they did and how they went about doing their work. I'll try to do as much of this as possible, but really the core of the whole thing, obviously, when you're talking about mission expansion, is to show where it went, when it went there, and who took it there. I don't like to limit it to that, but that's really the core of the outline. Columbanus, not to be confused with Columba, they're two different individuals, was one of these Irish wanderers in the area of what we know today, or what was known in the Middle Ages as Burgundy. In that area between France and Germany, as far south as Switzerland and northern Italy. And he wandered with his little group of of Perugini. One of the interesting things beyond the fact that he takes the gospel into these backwoods areas, and that's really the point, I think, not so much that it's an altogether new area of Europe where Christianity had never been heard of before. It is on the boundary area of the Frankish domain. But he takes it into the countryside. Columbanus, and his biography, his Vita, is written by Jonas, the monk Jonas, J-O-N-A-S. He tells us about how Columbanus loved the countryside and how animals, in turn, loved this missionary. He established three very important monasteries in this area of Europe, important because these monasteries, in turn, preserve Christianity, become the bulwark for the furthering of Christianity in later medieval Christian history. Then another individual who comes over is Willibrord. He comes to Frisia. Frisia is modern, is on the shelf. I believe that's in the Netherlands today. He comes to Frisia around 690. His biography, by the way, is written by Alcuin, who was the great teacher in the court of Charlemagne. Willibrord's mission is important because it's unlike Columbanus's in one way. Columbanus was very much of an individualist. He went where he wanted to go. Willibrord always worked in cooperation with the Frankish authorities. And it was sort of a peaceful expansion of Frankish rule into the area of Frisia via this missionary who took Frankish authority there under the flag of the Christian gospel. Willibrord also was very careful to do everything he did with authority from Rome. And that's another kind of missionary effort that we have in the Middle Ages. The next individual is Winifred, or Boniface, it's Boniface. There's an article in CTM on St. Boniface from 1954. And after this article, you will find another one written by an individual with whom I know you are familiar, Professor Malte, on preaching from the Greek New Testament. If you're not so interested in reading about Boniface, maybe you can go for the other. That was in 1954. Okay, we'll continue here tomorrow.